Hi, everyone, and welcome to The Week Ahead. I'm Tony Nash. Today, we're joined by Neelich Minga, Albert Marco, and Tracy Shuchart. We're starting the new year with a great episode, and Neely's going to talk to us about the U.S. consumer and employment. We had that JOLTS data come out yesterday and on Wednesday, actually, and I'm really interested to see what Neely expects in Q1. We're going to talk about Turkey. Albert has a lot of experience in Turkey, so we're going to talk through Turkey's geopolitical aspirations and kind of some of the roles they're playing in the Middle East with Russia and other places. And then with Tracy, we're going to talk about nuclear. And I'm really curious. I've heard about nuclear for years, and I'm just wondering, is nuclear overbought at this point? So I'm sure we're going to make some enemies by having that conversation, but it'll be a good one to have. So, hey, I'd like to make sure you know that you can access our AI-driven market forecasting tool called CI Markets for free. No strings attached, and it does not require any credit card information. Go to completeintel.com/markets to subscribe. CI Markets is the perfect addition to your analysis toolbox. This free account includes Nikkei stocks, major currency pairs, and global economics. Of course, we offer much more in our paid account, but this lets you experience CI Markets before making a financial commitment. CI Markets uses the power of AI to help you make better trading investment decisions. It's absolutely free. Again, go to completeintel.com/markets to subscribe to CI Markets free. So, Neely, thank you for joining us. I've been trying to get you on our show for a while, and I'm so grateful to have you here. So welcome.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, truly.
Great. Thank you. So one of your key areas is consumer, and I see you tweet about consumers a lot. You recently posted about consumers being overextended, and kind of consumers paying bills with multiple job holder data. Can you walk us through, I've got the tweets up on screen. Can you walk us through how loaded up are consumers and how are you seeing the ability to repay debt in the US today?
You know, it's precarious for some, it's easy for others. And I think that's what is going to be most revealing for this year. We're asked all the time, how's the consumer? And our first response is always, well, which consumer do you want to talk about? Right. And that nuance is something that I think that we're going to have to retrain the market to think through in 2024. Nuance is going to be where the alpha is. And that's how we're guiding our own corporate clients, as well as some of our other clients that we advise on the investment side. You know, one thing that immediately comes to mind is that debt level. We definitely have some consumers that feel so stretched that they choose to do buy now, pay later, or some people call buy now, pay never, right? And it's still an unproven mode. Still an unproven, you know, debt. It's still unproven, you know, and we've seen this way back in history before. Talking with another fellow Twitter friend recently, reminiscing, if you can call it reminiscing, around just like when Providian fell apart and the next card fell apart way back in the day, it kind of feels like buy now, pay later might be that next wave. Mm. So it just depends. It depends on the consumer.
Okay. So just to dig into that a little bit. So obviously, I feel like on social media, we see a lot of people who are probably doing pretty well, talking about the consumer in theory, not the consumer in reality, right? And if we look at, say, some restaurant like a Chili's or something like that, right? You know, these were places, not to pick on Chili's, but like these were places that through 21 and 22, they could pass on inflation to customers, right? The job market was healthy. So kind of their target market was seeing pay rises, not massive ones, but, you know, they were enough to keep up with some of that inflation. And so now we're seeing those pay rises stop. We're seeing the jobs switching stop. We're seeing the ability of those companies to be able to pass inflation on to their customers stop. And You know, my question, we talk about this fairly regularly, is will there be margin compression coming to hurt those companies? And will there also be demand kind of diffusion because those customers may not be able to keep up with that consumer spend given the debt loads that you're talking about?
You know, it's a great question. And we actually are watching restaurants very closely for signs on discretionary spending here in the month of January. If you rewind a year ago, January restaurant retail sales were off the chain. They were so strong. And we think it really contributed from two different factors. If you go back, that's when we saw like a high single digit cost of living increase among 66 million baby boomer retirees. That easily led to, you know, an incremental trip to get their baby back ribs, right? At Chili's.
Cracker Barrel and, or whatever, right?
Right. And like, you know, the OG Olive Garden did really well last year in the first quarter. You know, cruise bookings were really strong. I mean, things like this that are very much boomer centric. I'm sure someone's got a boomer ETF somewhere, right? And I'm sure it did really well. But overall, what we would say is the other thing was that it was really warm in January last year. Like really warm. So it extended a lot of the ability for those kind of or those restaurants that might have had outdoor seating. They were able to extend it into that month as well. So we're watching for the January numbers this year from a comparable perspective. The cost of living increase is closer to a low single digit this year. We all know that doesn't totally keep up with what the cost of consumption is right now, you know, at least the perceived cost of consumption. And we're kind of curious to see if this is going to be a little bit of the breakage. There is one more thing at play that's not boomer related per se, Tony. And that's we've had this tiny little quiet, no one's talking about it, payment pause on the student loans, even over the last 2 months. You can see it. We've also tweeted about that, student loans, student loan repayment. And it's because some of the payment processors were unable to meet some of the needs and demands, you know, of restarting after what 43 consecutive months of not paying.
And so we
think that there's easily 8 to 9 million people that have just not been paying that might have to go back into repayment in January as well. So there's a couple different factors that work against consumer spending and discretionary spending specifically that we could see play out in January. Okay. So we're watching it really closely.
That's a great point. Now you have another tweet. I want to talk about luxury in a minute, but you have another tweet where you talked about consumers feeling optimistic, and you talk about some reasons why their things might be different in the coming year. You've covered some of these things. The COLA increases, especially in Social Security. ERTC monies were flowing freely. Consumer spending hangover is more substantial post this holiday. Interest rates, early tax refunds in February, all this other stuff, right? So can you talk us through a little bit of that list? And those things, I think each one of them on their own would, I think, cause some concern in markets. But those things accumulated, you know, as you said, with the student loans, I'm not sure that we're, you know, we got like a fourth Q GDP now estimate yesterday that was just, you know, really stellar. And I think there's this assumption that these things are going to keep moving. I'm not a doomer, but, you know, at some point these things cause concern, right?
They do. And I think that's where, you know, I still go back to Danielle DiMartino Booth had a great interview well over a year ago. And I had the privilege of asking her a question around, you know, what is it that you would see that you don't necessarily fully, you know, what is it that you don't know that worries you? And she said, you know, private credit went to places it didn't belong, and or something paraphrased to that effect. And I think the same is true, you know, with consumer. You won't see it till it kind of blows up. I mean, the consumer loves to spend. It's a dopamine hit, right? Even if you go back to 2008, I was recently reviewing all the retail sales data, you know, right before the Lehman crash, right? Mm. And like retail sales were robust. It was really strong, you know, the month before Lehman fell apart. And right. Then it wasn't until you saw the job loss that people started to pull back on spending. So I think the consumer, unfortunately, will just be spending like all the way in to their, to whatever this is.
Right.
So looking for consumer spending as a optimistic leading indicator is not necessarily historically the right way to go. But you're right. We're concerned about a lot of little cuts to the consumer, whether it's the student loan payments, the lower COLA. People forget that tax refunds came a lot earlier last year in February. So a lot of people were flushed with the optics of cash in February and they spent it. That's not going to be there this February, or at least it'll be comparable. And then heaven forbid we have to actually have higher taxes on the other side of this, you know, political season. So we haven't even talked about what's going on with the election.
Oh yeah. Oh, we can talk about that for hours.
Yeah.
Let's talk about luxury for a minute, because Albert talks about luxury quite a lot. And I know he's outside and it's windy and people are going to complain about his sound quality on the show. But can you give us your view of luxury? And Albert, can you jump in here? Because Albert, you know, Albert looks at watches and, you know, luxury watch prices and, you know, all this stuff, and gives us observations on what's happening in Florida at the different, you know, luxury stores. What are you seeing in luxury? Like, is it pretty resilient? Are things falling off? You know, what's happening there?
I think I probably see Albert's posts about it, maybe, is what, you know, there's that infamous, like the Rolex watch, right? Sort of indicators that you, Albert, it probably is. That's obviously rolling over. But some of the luxury brands, even this fall, were signaling that they were starting to see kind of a slowdown in their business. And I think some people just immediately think like, oh, luxury doesn't ever slow. And there's some truth to that. Like the higher end consumer's fine. I mean, they will spend when they want to spend and how they want to spend it. It's the aspirational, incremental customer that aspired into that brand that is now gone. And so in some ways, that slowdown of people who had maybe been flush with the employee retention tax credit money, and now they don't have it, it's that incremental customer going away that you could start to see some things fall apart in luxury. Core high-end consumer, truly high-end, you know, people who don't, you know, quiet luxury consumers, they're fine. They're absolutely fine. I don't see any issue there. It's the marginal customer around the brands that we would want to be on watch.
And that's really where these brands
intended
provide their, you know, their additional value, right? I mean, it's those core consumers are going to be there regardless, but it's those aspirational ones. That's a great point. Albert, what's your thought on that?
No, she's absolutely right. You know, especially in the beginning of, you know, when she started talking about the nuance and numbers of consumer spending, you know, 10% of the consumers are spending probably around 40% of the spending. It's absolutely astronomical right now. And it transfers over to the luxury market. And Neely's right. Those marginal customers are gone. Those people that were flushed with money a year or 2 years ago are, you know, their accounts are dwindling, and now they're just, you know, trying to service their debts that they accumulated. To combat that, I saw that Rolex and a couple other luxury brands like, you know, Blancpain and, you know, Brunello Cucinelli rose their prices in Europe 8%. You know, It was just like, I think like 2 days ago, like Rolex announced that everything in the UK now is 8% more. So they're gonna slow down their production, whether it's watches, clothing, luxury cars. You know, they're gonna try to slow down production and raise their prices just to offset it. But yeah, I mean, the luxury market, although I am bullish for 2024, only because I know there's an election and there's gonna be money flying around everywhere. But long term, you know, it's not pretty.
So it sounds like almost a harder market segmentation than we've had for the last few years. Like when there's loose monetary policy, market segmentation kind of blurs, but now there's almost some hard edges coming in that segmentation. Is that fair to say?
It's, you know, it transcends everything. It's just like, you know, all the normal applications of what you would do to look at fundamental economics in the markets previously is absolutely not the case after COVID. Now that we're in a total different time zone, total different era, you know, things are more political than they are economic and financial at the moment.
Right. Okay, great. Now, before we wrap this up, I want to talk a little bit about jobs. We had some JOLTS data come out, and Neely, obviously with consumption, you know, jobs is always paired with that pretty tightly. What are your views on jobs and layoffs and, you know, other things in Q1? Are we going to see some serious slowdown there? Okay.
You know, it's, yeah, I think for, oh, somehow I.
That's all right.
Sorry. Somehow that went there. Hi. Okay. This, you know, for us on jobs, you know, jobs, of course, are always like the classically lagging, right? It's not a leading indicator, but there are some interesting things that we've been posting about, which could be somewhat of a leading indicator. So for example, multiple job holders, you know, some people will push back and say, you know, we're not insignificantly more in multiple job holders than we've been historically. Okay, that's fine relative to total employed. But you might want to look at multiple job holders per continuing claims. Like that's going to tell you something, right? Because it is, and it's delightful. I actually love the consumer. I mean, having led the consumer research practice at Piper Jaffray, which is now Piper Sandler, you know, for many, many years, took a dozen companies public, you know, spent 20 years on the sell side, right? I love the consumer. It has fueled and funded my future. And the consumer is extremely resilient and they care deeply about paying their bills. You know, sometimes I think we paint them in a picture that they don't. They will go work multiple jobs to put food on the table for their family. And so you've got to look at that multiple job holders relative to where continuing claims are, because if they lose that second job, they will not be able to file a claim typically on initial claims. So initial claims isn't what you want to look at. You want to look at continuing claims to see, like, will we be able to reabsorb them or not into the job market? And it's a pretty decent leading indicator. Similar to JOLTS, you know, with the quits data. You know, if you look at quits relative to continuing claims, it's a similar sort of dynamic. High correlation with the unemployment rate, if you look at that, those factors together. And again, that's been rolling over. So multiple job holders rolling over, quits per continuing claim rolling over. Unemployment's probably going to move higher, not just because of people unable to, you know, be laid off and unable to find their job, but we actually have people who are probably coming off the sidelines and expanding that labor force denominator as they unretire in order to pay bills as well. So I think there's a lot of little things in that, but they're going to do it so that they can consume, which is why consumption, you know, kind of doesn't fall apart until the economy falls apart.
So you, would you say it's notable but not concerning yet? Something like that?
Correct. Yeah, we're not in the camp that's like, oh, it's totally tight. I'm like, no, there's actually signs that things are loosening. If you look at different sort of indicators. The question is for how long and can government fiscal spending support it? You know, a lot of job growth has come from either direct or related government spending.
Huge fiscal,
So,
and that's another question I have is like now you hear the soft landing or some saying no landing scenarios, and I can't see that happening in 2024. You know, I still think that the government can float it up until at least after the election, but you know this soft landing, no landing scenario just it's just it's not plausible with all this loose money that's still sloshing around.
you know,
So you.
Albert, I think the one thing I got wrong all last year was the political will to extend, right? The you know, like that's what I got wrong last year. If I were to say, what did you get wrong, Neely? Because we were definitely bears because of the student loan repayment. Like it's a big deal. The political will to keep people from paying their student loans is just palpable. And that's going to continue all the way up until September 2024. It
Oh,
is an
without
election
question.
issue again. Yeah,
Yeah,
it's an
without
election issue.
question. And it's not just you. I mean, I've been in politics for God knows how many decades, right? And even I was taken aback of how venomly opposed they were to letting the markets like show weakness. You know, I thought, okay, for sure we're gonna have a soft recession or some minimal recession for like a month. They are absolutely not okay with that happening on the run up to this election. That's just the bottom line.
So the political will to spend other people's money is pretty strong. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, you can see it.
Of course. I mean, so
Look at the
Tracy,
deficit. Yes.
Tracy, can you
Yeah.
help us on the consumer side before we jump to the next topic? In terms of gasoline consumption, airline travel, you know, these sorts of things, are you seeing softness there? Because we're not really going to talk much about oil prices, but you know, are you seeing softness in gasoline consumption and crude consumption in the US, based on some of the things that Neely's talking about? You're on mute.
Actually, you know, if we look at oil demand in the US, we really haven't seen a change yet. In fact, it's even higher than that 2019 levels. And everybody, even the EIA, every year when they do their short-term energy outlook has been underestimating demand. And when they go back and give their 914 report, they have to go ahead and say, oh, we're sorry, demand is actually higher than we thought. And so in the US, we're just not seeing that. But again, when you have to look at gasoline and other demand, it's fairly resistant to even economic downturns because it's somewhat inelastic. Yes, people will stop going on vacations and driving on vacations and things of that nature,
Going to Applebee's.
but you still have to get your kids to school. You still have to go to work. So some of that demand is relatively inelastic. And what we have seen in the US is that we have seen demand continue to rise. And of course, since gas prices have, even though they are higher than, say in 2016 era, they're still lower than they were. And so this is also helping spur demand further. So we're just not seeing that. But again, like I said, even if we look at the great financial crisis in 2008, oil demand was the first commodity to rebound out of, or the first of anything to rebound because people went back to work and people went, after all the markets shit the bed, pardon my French, but it was the first thing to rebound. So, again, I go back to the fact that part of this demand is relatively inelastic. I mean, we're a big country. Everybody drives to work. Everybody has to put their kids on the bus to go to school or drive them to school. Or, there are just things that we need to do to function as a society in the US.
So at what point in election season, if we continue to see lower gas prices, do we hear people say things like, oh, low gasoline prices are a tax cut, which is the biggest joke?
Oh, no,
Will we
there
hear those words this year?
are, of course you're gonna hear that. Of course, we heard that, we heard that forever.
Oh
That's
my
not
gosh.
new. You hear that on, just on, interim elections. You hear that from congressmen, senators, and even your local congressman. And so, of course you're gonna hear that. It's a tax break, right?
It's not. But it is. That's what people say. So,
It's
okay, good.
not.
Thanks, guys. This on consumption and jobs is fantastic. You
Wonderful.
know about a new free tier we have within CI Markets, our global market forecasting platform. We want to share the power of CI Markets with everyone. So we've made a few things free. First, economics. We share all of our global economics forecasts for the top 50 economies. We also share our major currency forecasts, as well as Nikkei 100 stocks, so you can get a look at what do our stock forecasts look like. There is no credit card required. You can just sign up on our website and get started right away. So check it out. CA Markets free. Look at the link below and get started ASAP. Thank you. Fantastic. Let's change completely to talk about Turkey. Albert, you have a lot of exposure and experience in Turkey. You're in a piece on your cloak and dagger patron called the Geopolitical Roundup, looking at 2024. We talk about US politics, Turkey, the Middle East, China, multipolarity, Russia, the EU, kind of everything. One of the items that I really thought was interesting was your discussion of Turkey. And I really don't believe that Turkey is well covered by Western media for a lot of different reasons. So can you talk us through a few items about Turkey? How big of an influence does Turkey have on the Middle East and Africa? Let's cover that one first.
Well, look at a map. Look at all roads go through Turkey, especially through that, in that region of the world. Wheat, oil, gas, all of it goes through the Bosphorus, so on and so forth. I mean, the Turks and the Russians have always been at odds with one another in the Black Sea, especially. And the whole Iranian dynamic with smuggling routes through there is, it's a complex topic that we're probably not for this discussion. But the Turks are ambitious. Their economy is struggling mightily at the moment, but with cheap Russian fuel, they're at least keeping their head afloat at the moment. So, I mean, with Turkey has a lot of problems, right? But their defense sales are booming. Their mission in Africa to establish trade routes is booming, completely unopposed by Europe and the United States, completely. And they're actually working hand in hand with the Russians and Iranians in some sectors, you know, of the continent. It's, you know, it's actually quite amazing to me that no one in the media dares touch Turkey at the moment. I don't know why. I don't know, maybe because they're a NATO member and you know, the Biden administration doesn't really want to broach that topic at the moment. Obviously, all the Western countries are opposed to Erdogan, but I mean, he only has realistically 2 years left before he
Right.
leaves his, you know, illness.
So we saw, I guess, what, 10, 15 years ago, Qatar was putting a huge amount of money in Egypt and parts of Africa, and then things there fell apart, and then the UAE came in and kind of took over a lot of those investments. So is there some continuity from Qatar to UAE to Turkey? Is Turkey kind of filling in the hole maybe that the UAE had once, or are they filling a different need there?
Turkey is actually facilitating an anti-West settlement program to incorporate Iranian trade, right? They want to try, they're, you know, discussing on trying to stay away from the dollar and doing some little digital settlement program that's probably going to fall apart. But you can see the ambition there in Ankara's eyes. They want to be the dominant player. And on top of that, Qatar has been sending cash payments to Turkey whenever they get to the point where their economy is about to falter. You know, the plane loads of cash just ships right into Turkey. So there's
Okay.
obviously an importance there that the whole region sees.
Interesting. So Qatar is helping Turkey to stabilize economically.
Yeah,
So let's.
because Turkey has a military base there with troops in Qatar.
Right.
So
Let's talk
Tony,
about that a little
could
bit.
I
Even though,
ask,
yeah, go
could I
ahead.
ask Albert a question about this?
Absolutely.
If memory serves, wasn't the big earthquake like a year ago? Yeah, it was just a year ago.
So who's been coming in and helping them rebuild, or like, is there been some kind of natural disaster diplomacy that is not really being spoken of over here too that supports that? I mean, that was pretty disastrous, right?
Yeah, it was luckily it was in a rural area of Turkey. I mean, yeah, they had a huge amount of people lost, but it could have been a lot worse if it hit Istanbul. But yeah, there is a lot of corporations coming in that are, you know, Dubai or Qatar linked, most likely Chinese, you know, white companies that are just like labeled under Qatar domains and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, it's you know, everybody but the United States seems to want to help Turkey to gain favor. And it's just, you know, again, it's one of these complete failures of US foreign policy that we've seen for 30 years.
Okay, great. So kind of moving into that a little bit, you mentioned that Turkey has a base in Qatar. The US also has a base in Qatar. Are there other bases, other major military installations in Qatar?
I mean, relevant ones, probably not. I mean, I'm sure the Saudis have something there also. I can't even, off the top of my head, I can't even tell you, because the only ones I would focus on is the US and Turkey at the moment, only because Turkey, I've been in and out of Turkey doing business for the last few years.
Okay, interesting. Now, we've heard a lot about Turkish lira devaluation and lack of stability in Turkey's economy. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Is there hope on the horizon? Is Turkey stabilizing? It's interesting you mentioned that Doha is sending money into Turkey, which I didn't know about. So, is there hope on the horizon for stability in Turkey?
Yeah, but it's, you know, 10 years out really, because I mean,
Really?
I,
Okay.
the reality is the lira is just tanking. It's going to be weak for the next decade, right? But on the flip side, all business through their banks and on the street is done in dollars anyways. So what are they really hurting? Probably not a lot. I mean, obviously the bottom 75%, you know, no, nobody cares about them and the government, but you know, the top 25 and the businesses are all dealing with euros and dollars. They don't
Okay.
really see your lira problems.
Okay, so they're trying to facilitate, Turkey is trying to facilitate transactions in Africa in Iranian rials, but they're spending US dollars on the street in Istanbul.
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
Of course. That's how it
Interesting.
works. I mean, the Chinese do the same thing, but on the flip side, you know,
Yeah.
they'll lend out, you know, renminbi and they ask for dollars back.
Okay. Let's also look at what are Turkey's closest bilateral relationships? I know that they've had a troubled past with Russia, but What is that relationship aside from kind of the oil relationship now? Is there a true bilateral relationship there, or is it really just kind of an opportunistic economic relationship?
It's completely opportunistic. I mean,
Okay.
they have issues with Iran, Russia, and the EU and the Black Sea area. It's all that I've mentioned before. It's always been a problem. It always will be a problem of all four of those players trying to dominate that area. So the only relationships they have realistically are with, longstanding with Germany, although contentious at times, that's their biggest, one of the biggest communities outside of Turkey.
Okay. And just for the people who don't know, you really have to look at Ottoman history and Russian history and a lot of the fighting they did to really understand why that antagonism is so deep-seated. So you say Germany and Turkey has a tight bilateral relationship, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And that's largely because of the migrants that went from Turkey to Germany in the 1970s and have continued since then.
Yeah, I mean, Erdogan's even visited Turkey, Turkish communities in Germany multiple
Okay.
times.
Okay. Then what about China? Does Turkey have a good relationship with China?
Yes and no. They view the Chinese with, skeptical eyes. I mean, obviously, they're not going to give up their key ports to Chinese outfits like the Greeks did. They're
Right,
not
right.
that they're not that desperate for money at the moment.
Okay. And go ahead.
I have a question. We're looking at Russia right now wants to kind of build this very large natural gas hub in Turkey. So what, if any, do you see this being a problem with Turkey being a part of NATO? There's, obviously Russian sanctions against, all
Turkey.
energy in. So do you see this, foresee this being a problem if Russia does decide to have kind of Turkey be this big natural gas hub for them?
No, I mean, let's just be realistic. How do you replace Turkey if you don't want to have any kind of defense or offensive capabilities into the Middle East? It's impossible. So, I mean, all this chatter that, we should kick Turkey out, it's nonsensical. It's not going to happen. I don't care how many LNG ports they build over there in the Bosphorus, whether it's Chinese, Russian, or from Pluto, nobody cares. It's just the fact of the matter is that they're always going to be in NATO.
Speaking of that a little bit, Albert, Turkey does have quite a lot of defense exports, especially with UAVs. Do they compete with the Chinese for defense exports in places like Africa?
Of course, but nobody likes the Chinese stuff. It doesn't work. It's too cheap. It's not been proven in combat. The Bayraktars, which is the Turkish drones, are well proven, great pricing. I think they run for like 20, 25 million a piece, and it's hard to beat.
Okay. So I remember, last question on Turkey. I remember reading, I don't know, 20 years ago or whatever, George Friedman wrote this book called The Next 100 Years, and he said that there would be a re kind of assertion of the kind of the Ottoman Empire through Turkey, and Turkey would be one of the big geopolitical players in this century. Do you see that happening? Can Turkey really get it together to be a major geopolitical player this century?
No, not this
Okay.
century or next century. Their economy is like I said, barely afloat. Their military, although somewhat decent, next to their borders, they have no logistical capabilities whatsoever, and they have no leverage outside of them, being geographically important.
Okay. Interesting. Okay. Very good. Thanks for that. I want to come back to Turkey occasionally because it's so interesting, and I think it's so misunderstood in the West that I think it's a really important conversation for us to have. So thanks for that, Albert. Tracy, I want to talk to you about something that is, I think, probably going to make me unpopular. It may make you unpopular. Is nuclear? I think the nuclear guys, they're not quite as adamant as the crypto guys, but they're probably as adamant as gold guys. So, we've seen nuclear push up quite a lot lately. I've heard people pumping nuclear for years. It's an obsession for people, I think. Over the past couple of years, we've seen countries like Belgium and Japan claim that they'll revisit plans to open nuclear plants. And we saw with the earthquake in Japan this week that because of the safety protocols that were put in post Fukushima, that the nuclear plants were safe during the earthquake, which I think is really a good sign for reopening in Japan. So this week you posted a tweet on hedge funds loading up on uranium, which is interesting. And you know, we've heard this story for a long time, and so we've also got a screenshot of the uranium price. The uranium ETF obviously popped up in 21 and 22, and we recently saw a top. So I guess my question is, why are all these funds so bulled up on uranium? Like, is the near-term prospect for uranium as positive as many of the people have been pumping for the last probably 4 years?
Well, you have to look back at the history of uranium. It's been a very difficult trade. It's had its ups and downs. It's had its ins and outs over, the last 30 years or so.
Yeah.
So this is not new for uranium to see this kind of price action. That said, I do think that we've hit kind of a new phase or a new nuance in this particular market. Oh, sorry, this is my cat. Sorry about that. We can cut that out. All right, let me restart. So I think we have hit this new phase or nuance in this particular area. Now, do I think that prices may in the near term have gotten away from us a little bit? Yes, perhaps, but that's a good thing. That's a good thing overall, because what we're going to start seeing is that a lot of these projects, and we are in a deficit. Let's start with it. We are in a deficit because even though the West has largely shunned this since Fukushima and Chernobyl, we have had Asia pick up the slack. And I mean, that's where most of this demand and most of these new nuclear facilities have been scheduled to either have been started or, are under construction or plans under construction. And so that really hasn't changed. It's really been, kind of the West having this very negative thing about this. And what really changed this, I think notably this year was COP28, when nuclear was finally brought into the fold in talking about the green transition, because we haven't seen that, right? We saw in COP27. We saw natural gas finally brought into the fold. And then finally, we saw nuclear brought into the fold in COP28. We had over 25 nations kind of sign up saying we're going to triple nuclear energy capacity by 2050. Now, I would like to remind people this is totally an impossibility, logistically speaking. But the mere fact that they have signed up for this is a very positive sign for the nuclear industry, for the West in particular. And so I think that's very good looking forward. I also think that we are still, we've been in a deficit, even though we haven't seen this reflected in prices, because again, largely the West has disregarded this technology or shut it down, like look at Germany, for example. So I think that we've seen a new turning point. Do I think that this market's going to, prices are going to continue to skyrocket higher? I do think there's room to the upside. Do I think we're going to see a pullback at some point? Yes, because we have had such an escalation in prices. That said, so instead of kind of, if you're an investor, instead of kind of wanting to chase prices higher, uranium prices higher here, maybe wait for that pullback there, but maybe start looking into junior miners. Right. And junior miners are miners that I would look at miners that are already permitted. Right. They don't have to go through this hassle. They already have mine drilled holes. So they already know what they're looking at. They're ready to go. Right. As soon as these prices hit, and as soon as we started hitting, above, say, 65, we started seeing junior miners say, we can kind of get our projects off the ground now because we can, we can be success, we can make money at this. And so I think that's a really underlooked area at this point because, we've seen CCJ and all the big obvious ones explode along with uranium prices last year. And they did extremely well. But I think that in this new phase of things, in these new higher prices, what you're going to see is you're going to see the juniors doing more well. And I'm not saying CCJ is not going to do well, but I'm saying you're not going to see the 80% increase that you did probably in 2023. You'll see a lot less increase. And I think there'll be a lot more interest in junior minors again, but be very selective of the minors that you're choosing. You don't want people that are, I'm just trying to get my permit now. That's going to take 10 years. It's going to take billions of dollars. It's going to be over. But you want minors that are literally ready to go.
So that's great. Thank you for that. I
I
think
have a
that makes
question, Tony. I have a
Yes,
question
go
or
ahead,
maybe a
Albert.
statement. I don't expect Tracy to answer this, but how much of this investment drive for uranium nuclear is predicated off of the failure of alternative energies, of renewable energies, like hitting lately? Because I mean, we've seen wind power fluctuates significantly. We've seen, solar power problems and the supply chain problems and the cost going up. So I'm just curious if you have any insight.
I don't have exact figures, Albert, but it's great that you brought that up because I actually, I absolutely agree. And the confirmation of this was COP28 when we finally saw it, because we've already seen Ørsted this year, right? We saw Siemens this year. And then just yesterday, we saw BP and Equinor, dump out of wind. And so I think people have seen this coming. I don't know the exact percentage, but I would say that a lot is predicated on that. Absolutely.
So also if nuclear capacity is going to expected to come online at some point, who is making these nuclear plants? I would assume it's the French, the Japanese, and the Chinese. Is that right? Who actually constructs nuclear plants?
Well, right. Well, it depends. Actually, South
Korea.
Korea,
Yep.
you got even Bangladesh, believe it or not.
Wow.
It's a lot of Asian countries, or obviously Japan, that all China, of course. But I think that you're going to see renewed interest in the U.S., particularly because the U.S. is talking about banning Russian uranium imports, which accounted for about 25% of our uranium imports. And so if they're going to ban that, then where are we going to get this? So I think there's going to be a
Australia.
renewed. You can do Australia, you can do because Kazakhstan, you can do there are other places too, but why not get it from North America, right? Because we have some really great companies that we're looking at, not only in Canada, but also in the US, that have some great projects on the line.
Yeah, it's interesting. Over the past few months, we talked about kind of the cost of debt associated with building new kind of green projects. And obviously, the cost of debt associated with nuclear projects would be different or would be similar. But the lifespan of a nuclear project is quite long, right? You're talking 50 years or something.
You're talking decades. I mean, we
Right.
have nuclear facilities that are 50 years old that we just expanded another 20 years. I mean, so far we haven't really found an end to them. And those were, facilities that were literally built 50 years ago. Technology is obviously advanced further at this point. And again, you have to look at companies. I just want to keep stressing this. And I know I have three times already, but you want to have companies that are already permitted, that have
Yep.
already drilled, that already know what, that literally are ready to go. Because the other ones are going to take decades really to get the projects off the ground. And that's just being realistic as far as just looking at permitting alone is concerned.
Yep. Neely, did you
So,
have a
Tony,
question?
I would love to ask Tracy a question about this. I am not an energy expert by any stretch, but I think we do need to bring it back to politics for just a hot minute, right? And that is, Executive Order 13990, I think ultimately has been like the line in the sand against fossil fuel, drilling and production, that President Biden signed into. I think it was easily, I think, his first 12 executive orders he signed in when he took office. And what happens if we have a contender that moves over, from the Democrats to the Republican side? Do you think that's going to be one of the first like executive orders that gets eradicated, and then all of a sudden the fossil fuel companies are back in business again? I think through, from a board of directors perspective, could you green light big capital spending environment, projects in fossil fuels if you don't if you have political will against you, what happens when that political will is eradicated and removed? I'm just kind of curious your perspective on the political component of that.
Yeah, on the political side of things, I think that I think that there is still nobody wants to go 100% into fossil fuels, politically speaking. Nobody's going to do that except for, say Senator Manchin, that, he's West Virginia or whatever. So, but I don't think that is politically kind of a platform you want to run on. And so I don't think that we would see a complete 180 on this, and it would be all just fossil fuels again, because that would be politically going against half the country. It would be politically going against what the entire world or what the entire West is kind of looking at. And so I don't think anybody's going to run on, I mean, we've I
Let me
hesitate
help
to say
put on
this. I
this.
don't think anybody's politically going to run on a completely, let's forget renewables, right? And even
No,
if you have,
you would
it
need
would
a
be
whole
political
switch
source.
over. Yeah, you would need the Republicans to take majority both in the House, Senate, and the White House to be able to push something like that. And even then, the numbers would have to be so high that it would stop any kind of veto. So it takes a lot of it's going to be a while before fossil fuels will come back into favor in DC.
Yeah, the other consideration we just talked about is that cost of debt and this almost the substitutional factor with green power generation, right? And so I really as terrible as it sounds, I think it's really interesting how interest rates have brought some kind of reason back to the alternative energy space, and we're looking at the return on investment. So nuclear is, so for the people who hate me for what I said about nuclear earlier, nuclear, does have a lifespan of decades. So there seems to be really good value for money there compared to some things like wind and some other things that have really been hyped. And I don't hate wind, but I just am not really sure that it's there in terms of what do you do with the used blades, all this other stuff that are just really complicated issues.
And the same with solar as well. Look at solar panels, and I understand that there are many companies that are trying to figure out ways to reuse and recycle these products, but ultimately it's very hard to separate these metals from each other after they've been fused together. It's and very, and the big startup companies that have already started this kind of have pulled back on this even and have said, well, maybe we can't, maybe we had too ambitious goals at the beginning. And so I think the reality is just starting to set in, and it's not cheaper. If you look at the big countries, Germany, particularly in Europe, their energy prices haven't come down even as their share of renewable have gone up in their overall energy consumption profile.
Yep, very good. Guys, thank you so much. We have covered such a range of stuff today. It's pretty amazing. So we got the first one for the year and all done. So thank you so much, Neely. Really appreciate you joining us. You've brought an amazing perspective on consumers. And Albert and Tracy, as always, thank you so much for your time and all your thoughts, and have a great week ahead. Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank
guys.
you.